So, you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM, and this is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And before we get going today, I want to remind you that the views contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So, welcome as always at 5 o'clock on Tuesdays. We go and knock on someone's door for office hour. And so here we are. We're knocking on a door today. And I'm very excited today that the door we are knocking on is Professor Amy Matlag. I hope that was somewhat close.
Yes,
right. From Comp Lit Department, also connected to the MISA program here at Davis, who's going to talk with us today about modern Iranian literature. So that's going to be really a new area for us for today. So first, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Right. And you know that before we get into any particular research articles, we always ask our office hour guest how they became interested in the area and their area of research. And I think this is a very good question, because here we have someone growing up in San Diego, correct?
So correct.
Someone growing up in San Diego who grew up to be a professor of modern Iranian literature, which just doesn't seem like the most obvious thing to happen to a nice girl from San Diego.
Well, I think it is partially explained by the huge Iranian immigration, the wave of immigration that followed the 1979 revolution and resulted in a large population of Iranians settling in Southern California, primarily in Los Angeles and Orange County, but also in San Diego, which is where my family went.
Mm-hmm.
And so San Diego now has a huge Iranian population, but when I was growing up there, we were a very small group of people, and I'm from a half-Iranian family. My dad is Iranian and my mom is American.
Mm-hmm.
So for many years of my life, it was an identity that I ran away from.
Yes.
Particularly because I grew up in the 1980s and in the shadow of the hostage crisis. But around the time that I was in college, I started becoming more interested in that part of my heritage. And when I finished college in 1998, I let my dad convince me that it was time to go back to Iran and see what it was like. So I went on a trip for several months in the summer.
Mm-hmm. That was the first time you had been there?
Since I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I really fell in love with the language and the literature and the place. And I was surprised at how much I liked it. And I decided I wanted to spend some time studying it, in spite of the fact that I was told I would never have a job, ever. Here I am, that information notwithstanding.
Uh-huh. So when you were growing up, what was your home language? I mean, did you speak English at home?
With my mother, we spoke English. My dad spoke to us in a mixture of Persian and English, and a lot of my dad's family came to join us in San Diego. So I was surrounded by an extended family, many of whom didn't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandmother and my aunt spoke to me in Persian. So I had what I would call a passive knowledge of Persian, where I could understand what was being said to me, but I didn't like to answer in Persian.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
It wasn't until after I finished college and I was at a university doing a master's degree where Persian was offered that I started to study it formally.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you go to Iran and you have a kind of a life experience. And I will tell you, I hear that story a lot, that it seems to be that the motto of every good university should be go away.
I think that's good advice. Unfortunately, as an undergraduate, the place that I had done my study abroad year was at Oxford, which was a fascinating experience in its own way and cured me of being an Anglophile. But I wish now that I had perhaps another year in a place with a foreign language rather than in the UK.
Okay, so let's say that twice. I like to have that little advertisement. Everybody out there listening, you get a chance to go to a country that actually has a different language.
Yes.
Do that. Okay, do that. Go and learn. You will have an experience. Many people on my show have talked about how they've had a life experience and not expected it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you think you're going to go to a foreign place, it's going to be so difficult, and then actually having a really a life-changing experience. So then you come back, but why literature in particular, do you think, of the different possible ways you could study the culture? Mm-hmm. What was it about the literature that was so particularly interesting, and why particularly modern as opposed to maybe doing something more ancient historical or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had been an English major in college, so literature was already a passion for me. My focus was on British modernism. But I decided after, I sort of took a circuitous path because I also didn't go straight into a regular academic program. I did an MFA in creative writing and poetry.
Oh, really?
Yeah, before I did my PhD. And I decided that there were probably already enough people doing who were doing PhDs in English literature, and that my intelligence might be of better use to a literature that wasn't so heavily represented in the U.S., That's a sort of practical rationalization that came later, but at the time I was just reading sort of idly Persian novels, and I loved them. And I had grown up with the story of the blind owl, which became a big part of my first book, but my dad had kind of told it to me almost as fairy tales, which, if you've read the novel, now seems strange. But
well, it was the parent version, redone version, the PG version for children.
Sort of. Yeah. And so I was reading other Persian novels, and I felt like it was in a way a tragedy that these weren't getting more exposure in the U.S. The translations were sometimes very poor, or I felt like missed a lot of the important content or historical context. And I decided I would like to spend more time reading them and thinking about them, and that a PhD program would enable me to do that. And I wasn't quite as drawn to the classical tradition. I mean, you can't study Persian literature, modern Persian literature, without knowing the classical tradition. It has to be part of your training because it does have so much influence on the modern tradition and on the modern language. I mean, Persian is really full of, you know, idioms that come from classical poetry. But I felt that I had more to offer in the way of talking about modern literature, and my interests were really pulled towards the modern. And the story of the 20th century in Iran, which I think is really a fascinating story. A lot of people say it's a story of two revolutions, a kind of century bookended by two revolutions. And I was kind of interested in the different historiographical approaches to that, and also in thinking about how literature could illuminate the history of that period.
So much better. You get not only one, but you get to study two revolutions.
That's
there.
Right.
But one other point I wanted to go back to quickly, which was, what do you think the impact on your work happened to you because you did an MFA in poetry? It's not everybody who's an academic has done an MFA in poetry. I'm surprising how many people either have done one or wanted to do one. I think there's a lot of, I've seen many of the people I talk to, particularly in the field of literature, are drawn to the expression of poetry and not just the study of poetry. But I'm curious what impact you think that has had on your life or on your research.
It's had unexpected results. So I recently published an article on Galway Canal that I shared with you. And interestingly, Galway Canal was one of the founders of the program that I went to at NYU. And he had spent a Fulbright year in Iran, which is something that I discovered when I had him as a teacher. He said, "Oh, you're Iranian. Oh, you know, I spent a Fulbright year there. Do you know who Furukh Farrokhzad is?" And I was aghast because, of course, I know who Furukh Farrokhzad is.
Why do you know?
The most eminent, you know, woman poet of the 20th century in Iran. But he said, "Oh, yeah, I knew her, and she was a terrible driver." Of course, the sad part of the story is that she died in a car accident.
Right.
But that was something that at the time didn't have a big effect on me. But later I went back for a variety of reasons and read Canel's letters and his other writings from the time that he was in Iran, and I got a sense of how he had been influenced by Persian literature. So I would say that was one unexpected outcome.
Definitely unexpected.
Of my MFA. But another unexpected outcome was that it kind of sadly cured me of poetry writing. I still do write, but I actually write more prose fiction now. There was the experience. I tell all my students who tell me that they want to do an MFA, don't do it, because I think that MFA programs were really created to employ writers.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it bad to employ writers? I mean, maybe that's not a bad thing to do.
It is not bad to employ writers, and I think that writers should be ways for writers to receive salaries and have health benefits and all of those kinds of things, but I think I'm not sure that the MFA program is the best way to learn to write. Mm-hmm. I guess that was the takeaway. Although I learned a great deal there and I had wonderful teachers, but I learned that I wasn't sure I was a poet.
Well, that's a fascinating topic, and maybe we can return someday to talk in greater length about the MFA debate, because there's certainly many people who go through them and wonder what was the purpose of them beyond the good deed of employing the all those people. I mean, look, if people of the stature of Galway Canal are teaching, that means that if you're a poet, you're looking for a gig.
It's right? True.
You know,
it's true.
You're looking for a gig. So you stopped writing poetry and you turned now to studying this range of modern literature. And the first area that I want to talk with you about is the article that you gave me about memoirs. Mm-hmm. I think memoirs are incredibly popular, and I don't know if you have something general to sort of move us into the topic. Why is it that there are so many of those being published today, and the appeal of them? I'm wondering whether we live in a world in which people want to see history through an individual set of eyes, that there's something about one person leading you in the path, and that somehow making it seem more understandable, because there's just so much going on and so much information, and then when you go to one person's memoir, or whether maybe it's also just that memoirs are a little bit like gossip and there's a kind of an appeal, you know, but it maybe I wouldn't want to sit down and read a fairly dense modern history of Iran, but we're hearing a little bit of gossip through a memoir might be more appealing, or I don't know. You have any other ideas on why these are so popular right now?
I think all of those reasons. I think that it's important to see these Iranian-American memoirs as part of a larger turn in the U.S. towards memoir, which has started maybe 25 years ago. And is really also part of a broader turn towards reality-based entertainments. And we don't just see that memoirs are more popular, but almost all of our television shows have become focused on real-life experiences, or what purport to be real-life circumstances, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the earliest ones was an MTV show that I watched as a teenager called The Real World that sort of let the plug out of the dam on that one. But, I mean, it's hard to, I don't have a TV anymore myself, but I think it is hard to turn on the TV these days and not see a show that isn't kind of, or it doesn't purport to be reality-based. So I really see the memoir, the textual memoir, as being part of this broader trend, also part of a trend that brought us a president who gets up in the morning and tweets about his experiences and how he's feeling.
And thinks that's reality.
And think that's appropriate and that's a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has, the popularity of the memoir has done a lot to make us to notice, perhaps, how manipulable the idea of reality is, and what we think of as truth and truthfulness is.
So because every person has their own version of their own memoir.
Well, everybody has their own sense of the truth, but also, I mean, I think we have to really acknowledge that memoir encourages particular kinds of truth to be brought forward, right? And that, you know, as the French theorist of biography, autobiography, memoir, Philippe Lejeune says, you know, what we expect from memoir is truth with a lowercase t, and what we expect of fiction or poetry is truth with a big T, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're really different kinds of truth. And so we do tend to be more nitpicking, I think, when we look at memoirs. But at the same time, and I guess at the same time, to be very critical when we see people taking liberties with the truth of their lives, especially as in the case of the Iranian-American memoirs, when that one life becomes representative of so many other people's lives and experiences.
Exactly. So that's what you're talking about, is how when somebody writes and these are diaspora figures, so these are people who don't live in Iran anymore, write a memoir and kind of, you know, put their stamp and say, this is what the history is about, this is the experience, this is my reality. And then that leaves other people, other intellectuals with their own memoirs, to then have duke it out with each other about how, you know, is your memoir more correct than my memoir? And so let's talk a little bit about the specific debates that are going on. The one you're talking about is reading Lolita in Tehran, which certainly wasn't very popular, and I imagine that many of the listeners have either run into it somewhere or heard about it, or maybe picked up a copy or even read it. So it was very popular. I don't know if you want to say, that's not Nafisi.
Azar Nafisi, yes.
So I don't know if you want to say a little bit about why you think this one became particularly popular, and then we can talk a little bit about some of the critiques that then came. But first of all, it has to kind of like take up a lot of the oxygen in the room. It sort of becomes the lens through which Americans think about Iran. And how did that happen?
Well, I think she had terrific timing. I don't know if it was her timing or her publisher's timing, but at the moment that her memoir came out, the U.S. was just going into a war with Iraq. And so there, and we were already involved in Afghanistan. So there was a real thirst for information about women from this part of the world. And regrettably, Americans do not make a lot of distinctions between Iraq, Iran, yes, and Afghanistan. So I think that was one thing. I also think that the story she told was a very appealing one,
yes,
because it's about a book club.
Yes.
And it's about a kind of book club that's meant to be, you know, going against the wishes of the regime. She sets it up so that she explains how she used to teach at a university, but her teaching was too controversial, so she stopped teaching. But she invited her best female students to have a reading club at her house where they would read sort of the great works of Western literature, ranging from, you know, Fitzgerald to Nabokov and so on. And, you know, she told the stories of these young women's lives in, I think, ways that were very vivid and exciting to American readers. And I think the story of her own life is one that resonated with a lot of people. She'd been educated in the U.S., and she'd gone back, as many, you know, foreign intellectuals do, hoping to sort of take up a university post and take back what she'd learned in the U.S. and share it with her students.
And it didn't work.
And the time that she went back was at the time just after the revolution. So she wasn't able to do that. So she was a person with frustrated dreams. Some of the criticism of it comes from what she leaves out, I think. She's from a very elite family. She's sort of from a family that has generations of politicians and scholars. Her own experiences were very elite ones and unusual ones in certain ways. And she also seems to have a kind of lack of empathy for the lower classes that comes across in her writing and the way she talks about the woman who's a servant in her household and some of the other aspects. So that's some of the criticism that came later. But I think the initial excitement and interest in the book club was reading a book about a book club.
No, I think that's a very good point. And I think that, you know, in many ways, we don't know a lot. As a country, we're not well educated about other countries.
Sure.
And I think that, as you mentioned, where very few people probably can understand the difference between different countries.
Mm-hmm.
So the question becomes then, how do you try to get us to connect to that large world out there that is confusing and full of people who don't speak English? And I think the idea that a book club is a sort of a mode of translation, because everybody understands the idea of a book club.
Right.
It's very meta, very appealing. And then the idea that this is a book club that's reading the same literature that we're reading. We may be unhappily, you know,
yes,
maybe we were unhappily. Maybe we were unhappily made to read this in high school. But whatever, that somehow it builds right in there a kind of an identification.
Yes.
And I think that's what you're looking for, some kind of identification between the American reader and a very foreign experience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know whether you think that's good or bad, because, you know, before we go into other potential criticisms of her, I do think the question becomes when you make the familiar, or the, you know, make familiarize something that's quite different, whether you've, in a way, cheated for the American reader by making something more familiar through that translation. And I guess that's a big question for you in general, because you're trying to translate a foreign culture in Persian literature for Americans. But I wonder, I remember the time feeling when I was looking at it that there was something that was a little bit too simplistic, that
too
it was
easy,
making things fit together, my world and her world, maybe a little bit better than it really did.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I remember one moment where she talks about eating Haagen-Dazs ice cream in Tehran. I thought, wow, really going the extra mile to make the reader feel that you're just like them. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a kind of easiness that feels like she's cheating, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to note that the people who are kind of angriest about this memoir were scholars, right? Because we spend so much time, you know, scholars who work on Iran and teach in the U.S., people spend so much time being careful and checking all of their facts and trying not to make things too easy, in a sense, right? to give the full kind of spectrum of what's happening. And here's somebody who comes along who actually is trained as a scholar, right? She did a PhD in literature. Here's somebody who comes along, wipes all that out, and says, this is all you need to know about Iran.
Reading a familiar book, eating familiar ice cream. You could be in Davis, you could be in Tehran, you could just be, and we'd be having the same discussion.
Yeah.
And in each case, we'd be talking about how much is the government impinging upon our capacity to have this discussion.
Sure.
So, terrific. Well, we've reached the end of our first segment here on Office Hour, so stay with us. We have a few announcements, and we will be back in just a minute. So, we are back now with segment two today on Office Hour. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And today we're talking about modern Persian literature, particularly literature from Iran, with Amy Matlag from the Comp Lit department, whose last name is actually Persian, right?
It is.
So it is Persian. So she's now going to say it for us correctly. Not that any American will ever know, but it's always good to hear a little bit of Persian. I'm not asking you to read a lot of literature. Sometimes we, you know, somebody works in a different culture. So we will now hear a correctly pronounced Persian last name.
Motlak.
Okay, there it is for you. Okay, good luck.
It means absolute.
It means absolute.
It does.
Okay, terrific. Well, so what we were talking about in the first segment was this collection of memoirs that are kind of arguing for whose memoir is better. And one of the critiques of reading Lolita in Tehran, which we were just talking about, was maybe that she made it a little bit too simplistic. I think also in this world, the worry I imagine would be that you don't want any one memoir to dominate, that any memoir might be taken to be evidence of more than it is, which is one person's experience.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe a memoir in the first place is not the greatest thing to use as the lens. I don't know. It seems like they loom very large, as we said now, so they seem to take up a lot of importance. But on the other hand, they are just very somewhat idiosyncratic, wouldn't you think, in each case? And that her case is somewhat idiosyncratic?
I think they aren't, in fact. And I think if you read enough of these, you really start to see patterns emerging.
Hmm.
And that has a variety of reasons. One is that publishers encourage memoirists or would-be memoirists to write particular kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also rejecting kinds of stories that they think will not sell.
Mm-hmm. So what is the sort of push to the genre? What is the genre of the modern Iranian memoir that maybe in the case of reading Lolita in Tehran, how would you sort of characterize how that fits into it? Is it about social conflict? It is that there's a sort of a similar social conflict in them, or what sort of makes them, as you say, actually quite similar?
Well, I would say two things. One, there's a generational divide. So Azar Nafisi is from my parents' generation, and I
uh-huh.
think people of that generation are writing one kind of memoir, and people of my generation, people who are often born in Iran and lived there until they were, you know, a few years old or maybe even 10 years old and then left to come to the U.S. and then go back. That's what has been called the memoir of return.
Mm.
So memoirs like Lipstick Jihad, there are a few others that are in that category, actually quite a few. But the other point I wanted to mention about this there's the similarity, but there's also the idea that, I don't know if you remember from the 1980s, there was a memoir called Not Without My Daughter published. And one scholar, Farzan Emilani, has suggested that in a way all of these later memoirs are oddly enough taking that as a model. So it's a kind of, it's a memoir of imprisonment and escape. So that, I think, reading Lolita in Tehran kind of has that's its sort of motif.
Mm-hmm.
And then the return memoirs have a different kind of quality in that it's about people like me who grew up hearing what an awful place Iran was from the larger public, not understanding our identity, not understanding where we fit into American multicultural politics. They go back to Iran. Oftentimes they have a romantic encounter and or get married, and it's a redemptive trip.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they come back to the U.S. and write their memoirs and now live these kinds of lives between Iran and the U.S. They're very cosmopolitan lives. So these are really memoirs coming almost exclusively from, you know, kind of elite population.
That can literally fly back and forth.
That can literally fly back and forth.
Okay, well, that's a really interesting point. So the point you made, and I guess not having yet written my memoir, I haven't thought about this a lot, which is like, what is the memoir I have to read before I write my memoir so it'll be acceptable? And that there's an escape motif for a while, and everybody's And it doesn't matter. In my mind, I see the memoirs being individual, and you're saying, no, really, there's a kind of a motif for one generation, and then the next generation is sort of the rediscovery of their heritage, the positive value of heritage. And that, again, fits into a much broader set of motifs. It's not just about Iran. It's about all kinds of people in America rediscovering the importance of their heritage. So what I think is I found kind of amusing is that now all these people are duking it out. And they're all kind of like saying, no, you can't be the memoirist because my memoir is different and it's presumably better than yours. And I couldn't completely understand what they were arguing about. One point which I think would be of interest to our listeners is that the memoir gets connected to political agendas.
It's connected to, unfortunately, the study, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the study of Iran in the U.S. is politicized.
Yes.
It's also a very small field. Iranian studies is a very small field. I always say that going to the Iranian studies conference is like going to a family reunion. You know everybody, and you're probably related to most of them, too. But the case, and so in the case of these scholars that I talk about in the article that you read, I mean, many of them knew each other already. Hamid Dabashi and Azar Nafisi knew each other. I'd been, you know, I think fairly well. So the way that these scholars turned on her, I mean, I think that's an apt expression because it really did feel like a betrayal where they at first, everybody was at first celebrating this memoir.
Great to have a book out that everybody wants to read about modern Iran.
Yeah, and that it's a positive representation. And then about a year later, you started seeing these articles saying like, no, she's in fact misrepresenting us. There are all of these problems with the memoir. Mm-hmm. This is not carefully done, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that I really was concerned about in that article and more generally in the kind of discourse is that at the same time that they're rejecting the memoir as a genre, as an appropriate way to represent Iran in the U.S., the memoir has crept into their scholarship.
Right.
So now it's important to talk about how you're from Iran or how many times you've been to Iran. And so forth, as a way of establishing your authority to speak about Iran.
If you're going to critique another memoir, you better have your own one up your sleeve.
Exactly.
Even if you're really scholarly in a certain other kind of way, you still have to, only another memoir trumps a memoir. I'm wondering whether, because you went by it fairly quickly, the politicization of the study of Iran. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we can unpack that a little bit to help everybody understand what that means.
Sure.
Because I'd say that's quite confusing. On the one hand, we're talking about literature, and we're talking about people just writing stories about growing up. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you're saying everything is political because of the contours of the relationships between Iran and America and because of the internal revolutionary experiences in Iran.
Right. So before the 1978-79 revolution, a lot of Americans lived in Iran, did research in Iran. I myself, my PhD advisor, was somebody who'd done a Peace Corps year in Iran. I mean, these were people who had spent time there. They really knew the language. They felt comfortable there. That changed after 1979. Americans have a very hard time going to Iran. Things like the Fulbright program were totally cut off for Americans going to Iran until, I think, like the early aughts. And the first person who had one of those was an Iranian-American. So for a long time, the only people who could go to Iran were people who had Iranian passports or, in some cases, very persistent Europeans. So the field shrunk a great deal, and the number of perspectives, I think, on the field shrunk.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, that's still the case today because it's really only people who are dual nationals or nationals, Iranian nationals, who can go easily. And as we've seen, perhaps you've seen in the news, people who are dual nationals, even when they're just scholars and they're not political in any way, sometimes they are arrested or otherwise persecuted during the period of their field work in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way in which it's been, the study of Iran has been politicized and I think limited.
Mm-hmm. Well, Davis had a lot of relationships with Iran as a university, so and of all kinds of types. So I know I've been at meetings and I've talked with chancellors in the past about their attempts and wishes to make those connections. So that certainly makes sense. Now, if you can more specifically orient us in terms of a specific memoir, how does if everything is political, what kind of political contours do the different memoirs take on? You sort of seem to discuss that some of them get, that memoirs get divided up sort of and attached to American political positions, even if that may be not necessarily what they were originally written for.
Well, reading Lolita in Tehran probably was written for American political positions. I mean, one of the things that was noted about this and criticized was that she thanks people like Bernard Lewis, Paul Wolfowitz, other people associated with the Bush, George W. Bush's administration, in her acknowledgments.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she taught at Johns Hopkins and was a colleague of Wolfowitz. So she was seen as somebody who was kind of in the thick of this, of the Bush administration. But I mean, more broadly, I mean, it's also really important, I think, to note that almost all of the memoirs that get published are by women.
Mm-hmm.
And a major criticism has been that these kind of promote the idea that Iranian women need to be saved, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's
mm-hmm.
this, you know, brown women needing saving from brown men kind of ideology that has pervaded a lot of the discourse on Afghanistan, on Iraq, and other kinds of places where there's been U.S. military intervention
mm-hmm.
in the past 10 to 15 years.
So in that way, then, the memoir is becoming used as a sort of a political tool to argue for the oppression of women,
mm-hmm.
and that you read through the individual case of a woman having trouble with this or having trouble with that, then becomes a tool for explaining that all women in Iran are like this, and that's why we have to go over there and save. These are the specific lives, and that maybe somehow that helps organize people's minds much more than the very complicated actual politics on the ground, which is just simply too complicated, you know? In other words, the one thing about this is it's nice and simple. You know, you read a memoir, this woman, and you think that she needs to have problems. So you're appealing, I think, in this to what might, on one hand, seem to be a good nature or a good theme of American society, that you want to liberate women, but you're ultimately doing it for much more reactionary purposes.
Yes. Nefarious purposes. I mean, it's Laila Abu-Logt has written a great piece
yes.
on this. And there's also a great book by, I think she's an Australian scholar, Gillian Whitlock, about memoirs as soft weapons. And she looks at memoirs from Iran, Iraq, and a couple other contexts, looking at the way in which, even if the intentions of the author were never to sort of promote an invasion of a place or to provide scaffolding for U.S. military intervention, nonetheless, they do become part of the conflict, right? With or without the consent of the author, they get drawn into the kind of discourse that justifies military intervention and the so-called liberation of brown women.
They get used as they get used for purposes which may not, even though in this case you think that may have been part of the original purpose. But what about all the other ones that you've been talking about that are not reading Lolita in Tehran? Do all of them end up sort of getting sucked into sort of political debates because of just the nature of writing memoirs by somebody who doesn't live in Iran anymore? Or is that just what happens to people when an Iranian intellectual in the diaspora who doesn't live in Iran writes a memoir, it's going to fall somewhere. It's going to be put into some political argument. It's going to be seen as fodder for some one political argument or another, just by the nature, by its nature.
Well, you know, the only memoir that I know of that has kind of evaded all of this stuff, and everybody loves it. Iranians love it. Americans love it. French love it. It's a French Iranian author, Marjane Satrapi, and it's called Persepolis.
Yes,
it was made into a film.
Yes.
And even though it's outrightly political, right? It's really about her childhood during the revolution, and she's very critical of everyone. Basically, somehow she comes out smelling like roses. I love it too. I'm going to teach it next quarter in an autobiography course. So I think that she somehow managed to, possibly because of the nature of it being graphic, you know, that there are visuals to somehow that undercut or managed to lend greater nuance to some of what she was saying in a way that a purely textual memoir couldn't. I'm not sure. But it's ironically explicitly political and yet hasn't been politicized in the way that reading Lolita has or some of these other memoirs that I've mentioned.
Well, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really interesting point. And I have read Persepolis,
mm-hmm.
and I think a lot of people have, and
mm-hmm.
I highly recommend it. If that's a first run out and buy this after you listen to the show, I think that's a good read. And then maybe you can, all of our listeners who go out and read it, can ask themselves the same question we're asking now, which is, that, you know, why is this so successful? Because it was incredibly successful.
It
and then you said it was made into a movie and it was successful in that as well. And that somehow it transcends some of the skirmishes
mm-hmm.
that are going on with other memoirs about who has the right to, who has the best political position and who's going to be used for what, that somehow she just manages to seduce. I don't know, maybe that's...
I think it's partly because it's a child's perspective. I think that's one way she gets around it. Most of the other memoirs are told by adults, right? They're even if they're looking back to a childhood, they're talking about their experiences and their perspective as an adult. But that is really a child's point of view. And so there's a certain amount of, you know, I don't want to say feigned naivete, but a way of seeing that is both appealing and that we understand to be incorrect, right? Because we can see what happened. Mm-hmm. So the ways in which she initially apprehends or understands what's happening around her, you know, we already know as readers that she's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And she's going to mm-hmm. learn that, that's wrong.
Hmm. Yeah. So at the end of this all, when you've led us through and thought about all these different people who are writing about their experiences as people who live outside of Iran, at the end of the article, you argue that they need to acknowledge what you call the responsibilities and the perils of being part of this diaspora Iranian community, that they don't live in Iran, but mm-hmm. they write about Iran. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you could expand that a little bit for us. What do you mean the responsibilities and the perils of being part of the Iranian diaspora? Because mm-hmm. that's just where they live. They live in America, right. Even if though they have that heritage. So what are the responsibilities that they have? Does that mean that they have a certain type of reporting they should do, or... What do you mean by that?
I think it means being very cautious about what you say about Iran and the ways in which you represent Iran in your scholarly writing, if you're a scholar in your scholarly mm-hmm. writing, if you're a memoirist in your creative writing. It's an identity. There's actually a woman right now who's, I think, she won the Pulitzer. She's become a hot topic in the U.S., Otessa Moshfiq. She's also an Iranian-American writer. She does not write about Iran at all. It has nothing to do with her work. She's unusual in this regard. But I think it's an interesting position to have taken, right? And maybe it's a reaction to the ways in which it is so difficult to be an Iranian-American and to talk about Iran. Because whatever you say... is going to be taken down by somebody as the absolute truth because they don't have any other information about it. When the sanctions were lifted a few years ago, sadly, they're now back in place. Many of us in the scholarly community, the Iranian studies community, were really excited because we thought, well, now there are going to be more people going to Iran, more scholars working on Iran. There will be kind of less solipsistic representations of Iran rather than all of these memoirs and other accounts that are about me, and what I know about Iran.
And I flew on the plane. This is what I ordered. This was my special meal on the plane. Exactly. Yeah. There was going to be, and then, of course, it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. And that is just part of this kind of long history, this multi-decade history after the revolution of back and forth between the U.S., you know, one step forward, two steps back kind uh-huh. of thing.
Well, I think your point about diaspora is very interesting in general, because we are aware of many people in America who come from heritage traditions mm-hmm. and represent the diaspora. And just from other examples that I can think about it, the voice of the diaspora is loud. Sometimes it's a very loud voice that is able to say things without necessarily knowing or being aware of the consequences of what they say. And I was wondering if that was sort of what you're talking about here as well, that there are perils for being part of the diaspora, because the diaspora community is free to just speak from the distance and in a way represent without necessarily representing and things like that. I know in some of the cases I would think of the diaspora community may be more radicalized than the homeland community, or they may be more militarized or maybe more supportive of the military rather than the people in the homeland itself. So I don't know if you feel you're willing to make any sort of larger global sort of points about what does it mean to be part of the diaspora community in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the whole idea of diaspora is a new one for Iranian Americans, and it's really entered, I think, into the American idiom only recently, maybe mm-hmm. in the last 10 to 15 years. I have a cousin who also works on this stuff. She's a writer, and she talks about the diaspora, and my uncle was saying to us, there's a diaspora, and we're in it? So it's really conceptually new, and it's really of my generation, not my parents' generation, but... I think that it's a dangerous position to be in because you have so much power in a certain way. You do have this freedom to speak and say whatever you think right. and you want to say. On the other, and to kind of profit from that, because people, there is a thirst for entertainment and information about Iran. I think somebody like Reza Aslan, the sort of entertainer, he does all kinds of things.
Yes.
Is a good example of this because he represents himself both as a scholar, but also as a writer and all these other things. It's really unclear to me what his connection to Iran actually is, except that he had some Iranian parentage.
Right.
And then I find myself thinking, like, why am I thinking about this guy's Iranian parentage? But it really is part of the credentialing for the yes. diaspora to know, like, yes. has he been to Iran? When was he there? Does yes. he speak Persian? And so on and so forth. I think the peril is that, you know, he had this show called Believer that had this opening montage of images of the revolution and sort of women in chadors and mobs and then him as a child, I guess, in Iran, that were really emotionally and evocative, right? They were meant to solicit particular kinds of emotions for the reader as a setup to his discussion about whatever religion he was looking at. And I think that people like that do not, I hope they don't think, I hope they haven't already thought about it and done it anyway, but I don't think he is thinking about how those images are affecting people in Iran who continue to live there, right? And who are the victims now of U.S. policy once again, right? In what ways do all of these representations that we see in the U.S. about Iran, like reading Lolita, like Believer, myriad others, how do they affect how Americans view Iran, and then how does that affect American political and military policy?
Well, that's a very sobering point you've made, and I think it's a very important point that as I was saying, that the diaspora looms large, right? And people can speak there, and they get a special kind of echo chamber that echoes back to the country where people who have to live with consequences in a way that this and that diaspora spokesman may be there just, you know, flash in the pan for a while. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really good point. And I think on that, we're going to close the second segment. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about at least one specific example to excite the listeners to go out and read a Persian novel in English. So when we come back, we will take care of that on the last segment on Office Hours. So stay with us. So welcome back to the third and final segment on Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And today we are talking with Amy Motlag about Persian literature. So we wouldn't want to finish out the show without actually talking about some specific Persian literature, right? Because everything we've been talking about has been American-Iranian That's literature true. So far. So, my guess is that not very many of our listeners will ever have heard of this, but this is one of the greats. It's called The Blind Owl.
That's right.
And you mentioned at the first segment that you had actually heard about this growing up. So this is the kind of novel or story that people would widely be aware of and fathers tell children and things like that.
It's one Iranian historian has said that every Iranian knows the first lines of this story.
Okay, so it's kind of like
I said the first few words, and you were Iranian, you would be able to say the next few.
Words.
Sort of, yeah,
it's sort of like the dark wine sea of the first line of Homer.
Yes, although probably very few Americans can recite that. But
yeah,
yes,
I guess I chose. It says something about me that I even thought about that, and we won't say what it says about me. Right? Okay, so I know it can be very difficult. But this is available in English, correct?
It is.
So people could run out and read The Blind Owl by Sadiq Hidayat. Okay.
Yes.
And I know it's very, very difficult, but to get us started, whatever you can give us is sort of like a plot summary, or the closest you could get to a plot summary. I take it there's a blind owl, or is there no blind?
No, there's no blind owl. This is part of what's confusing about the novel. People are always like, what is the title? What does that mean? It's a novella, so it's actually quite amazing that so short a book could be so dense and have had such a profound effect on the modern Iranian literary imagination and the modern Iranian imagination, I think, more broadly. It had a huge cultural impact. It's about, the story begins with an artisan, a kind of hermit artisan who paints, if you've perhaps seen many people who have an Iranian friend or something, if you've been to their house, they oftentimes have a pencil box that has an image that looks like the kind of Persian miniature painting of a woman bending over like this, offering tea or wine to an older man, a sheikh. So that's his job. He paints pencil boxes or pen boxes with this image on it over and over and over, the same image. One day he goes into his closet and there's a little hole in his closet, and he looks out the window and he sees the image that he's been painting outside of the window.
So it's jumped up off the pencil box and it's actually outside.
Outside. But, of course, it disappears. It doesn't stay there. Later, shortly, not too long after this, the painter, the artisan, opens his door, and the woman from that scene has appeared, comes into his house, lies down, and dies. Okay. Not knowing what to do with her, he cuts her into pieces.
Oh, that's obvious, right?
Wraps her up in a bundle and prepares to take her away. When he goes outside, there's a man waiting for him in a wagon who appears to be the sheikh, or the old man from the painting.
From the pencil piece.
Yes. So you already can get a sense that there's a kind of recurrence of these archetypes. They show up in different characters, even in just this first part of the story. This man takes him into the desert, where they bury the body, and then they return to the artisan's home. And then that's about the point at which the story breaks.
Okay.
And then we start another story, which seems to be very similar to the first story. But in this story, the beautiful woman is the narrator's cousin. And they've grown up together. They've been, it's called Hamshir. They've been suckled by the same mother, even though they're not brother and sister. So they're then forbidden to each other for marriage. But he's in love with her, and she's sort of this elusive, beautiful, cruel woman. And eventually he's going to kill her too. So in these, it's a bifurcated story, but it has these kind of common sets of characters doing different things.
And in both cases, it's dangerous to be a woman.
It's dangerous to be a beautiful woman.
A beautiful woman, because you get chopped up. And one of the things you write about, and I thought this was fascinating, is you're complaining in the article you gave me that not enough people write about the chopping up of the lady.
That's right.
People write up, so
more dismemberment, I say.
So what your point being that it would seem to me that that is a fairly important part of the story. But yet it's not something that's written about a great deal. So you're going to come in and you're going to explain to us why dismemberment is important.
Okay. My contention in this book that I wrote, Burying the Beloved, is that at this period of time that Sadegh Hidayat was living, in the early 20th century. There were a huge number of social changes.
Yes.
Related to women's status, related to the sort of hetero socialization of public space, which had been much more segregated up to that point. So, you know, you have women in public spaces where they hadn't been before. Mm-hmm. And you also have at the same time language reform and the rise of prose fiction. So up until this time, poetry had been the dominant literary form in Iran. As I mentioned, it's something that it wasn't just an elite form. It was really something that everybody knew, right? Many, even from every walk of life, people had memorized the poems of Hafez,
right,
of Rumi.
Right.
And it's really part of the language. The interesting thing about the beloved in that poetry, that classical tradition of poetry, is that there's a lot of room for ambiguity in the gender of the beloved.
So we went from a culture of poetry, which we've talked about in a number of shows, in which, you know, the cultures in which poetry was important, and in particular in this case, ambiguous gendered poetry about the beloved.
Mm-hmm.
And we see two things happening. One, vast cultural changes, which mm-hmm. reposition the role of women,
mm-hmm.
and a shift from the classical poetic tradition with the rise of prose. So this novel, which what you say we should all read, so we are educated people, is kind of happening at that interface.
It is.
So it's the prose coming in, but still, women can be problematic, but do you have to chop them up? I mean,
well, this is, I mean, the interesting thing about Persian is that it is not a gendered language. So the pronoun for he and she is the same.
Mm.
And in poetry, that allows you a lot of room for ambiguity. In prose, it doesn't. In spite of the fact that you're using that same pronoun, if you're telling a story,
yes,
you have to reveal the gender of the beloved, right? And in this particular social climate, it would be inappropriate to have a homosexual relationship, right?
Right.
Which could have passed and did pass in classical poetry very frequently. Homoeroticism was very common to the classical tradition.
Because you weren't even sure when you were reading the poems.
So. Yeah, very right. unclear. You could read it how you want, to some extent. And so in this book, what I argue is that this beloved is a kind of metaphor for the beloved from the classical tradition that has to be literally taken apart and reconstructed, or what I say, I use this neologism that I coined, remembered as a wife or a female beloved. Mm-hmm. And that this novel is really engaging that idea of the transformation of language at this particular historical moment.
And a transformation of the role for women,
yes,
as well.
Yes, both.
So we can make some guesses at what you started with. You started with this non-gendered poetic beloved figure. I guess the question would be, where do you end up with mm-hmm. this transformation? You've now moved into prose. Mm-hmm. You've now gendered it. You've now chopped it up. What's a remembered woman like? What's a woman who's membered, you know, has been all put back together again?
Mm-hmm.
Is she the same woman, or does she look the same as before she was dismembered and put back together again? Are we talking really about that this is a form of social transformation, so that when you put her back together again, even if you started with all the same parts, mm-hmm. you end up with a very different woman?
I mean, I think Sadek Hidayat could not imagine that. And that's what the novel is about, that it's impossible to imagine a female beloved who lives, right? A living female beloved. But what I argue in the book, and the kind of broader argument, is that people do begin to imagine a female beloved, right? And a female wife, and eventually even female protagonists. And that especially as women begin to write, you have a real transformation, and you do see, starting with the first novel that's written by a woman in Iran in 1969, you do have a woman protagonist, or at least a woman narrator, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting in that novel is that I would say that that novel has a hero who's a man and a protagonist that's a woman. So it's kind of an interesting conflict where you have this hero who's clearly also from the classical tradition and is a man who's martyred, which is a common occurrence in Persian literature even from before the Islamic tradition. But then you have this female protagonist who lives, who outlives him, and has to go on living in this new world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think it's a really fascinating period in Persian literature.
So, yeah, it sounds extremely interesting. So what you're talking about really is that maybe there's some limits to what the male author can do.
Mm-hmm.
As you're saying, the putting back together of a new kind of woman for the new world of Iran in mm-hmm. the early 20th century, there's some limitations for what he can do. He is transferring us from poetry into prose. He is laying out societal problems,
mm-hmm.
And he is using very vivid imagery. I can imagine mm-hmm. that it's quite a set of vivid imagery. But maybe what you're saying then is it takes to the 1960s a female author then to come along and do the next stage of reconfiguring what it means to be a woman by then actually writing her own new story? Or is that, am I making things fit together a little bit too easily?
Maybe a little too easily, but I mean, I think that is what happened as I see it, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But it maybe isn't what had to have happened, but it is what happened in Iran, that the Iranian authors who were writing couldn't quite imagine a female protagonist with the tools that they had and the literary tradition that they were using, and that it really took this particular and extraordinary female author to do so.
To come along in the 1960s mm-hmm. and move the whole process, the transformational process. It still seems like it's somewhat distressing that she's chopped up. I don't know. I'm sort of stuck on that part of the novel.
And
I'm just curious how you think that fits in. Are we saying that the old has to be destroyed in order to build something new? Maybe that's the best possible reason, way reading we possibly can come up with under some pressure to try to do a reading that isn't just concerned about the fact of the expendability and the violence,
I think so. I was kind of reading against a criticism tradition about this novel, because it actually is an incredibly famous novel, and it's also perhaps the only novel from the Iranian tradition that has the claim to be world literature, because it's been translated in so many ways, mm-hmm. it's been discussed by scholars from so many other traditions. But it had largely been read as a kind of misogynistic novel, and I wanted to read it, even though I'm obviously interested in the social milieu in which he wrote it, I wasn't just interested in seeing it as, oh, this author was a misogynist. I really did think that what he wanted to do was take apart the tradition, and he knew that that had to be done in order for Iranian literature to move forward in the way that he thought it should. And so I really see that particular act of dismemberment as a metaphorical one and less as a literal one, right? It's less about violence towards women and more about this kind of anxiety about how you deal with a female beloved in the prose tradition.
I'm just curious quickly before we have to end. With this huge transformations, again, we started the hour talking about there have been two revolutions, that's all in Iran. Do the men have to be remade too, or is there a way in which remaking the women is more symbolic of the remaking of the society?
Men definitely have to be remade, and there's actually a lot of new and really good scholarship coming out right now about Iranian masculinities, as is often the case. There's a lot of focus on what happens to women at a moment of modernization. I'm putting that in scare quotes. But there has been a lot of scholarship on that topic, and now there's been a turn, and there's more attention to what happens to men and the ways in which men have to be transformed, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating. So I want to thank Amy very much for coming on the show today. So
Thanks for coming on.
And you can find her. You can work on your is there a little thing on your website to help people pronounce your Persian last name?
Maybe I'll add
that. So it's MOTLAGH, just so you can find her on the Complet, and there will be a link you can find under our archives to her website, and you can find out more about the Persian literature, and in addition to The Blind Owl and the other things we've talked about on the show. And you can also find other shows. So I always want to remind you that it's OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com, OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com, and that's where all of our shows are archived. And we will be back next week with a new show. We'll knock on somebody else's door, and we look forward to that. So in the meantime, go forth and read The Blind Owl and see if you can figure out exactly what all that chopping and remembering is all about. Okay? Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.